All right, let's hope that all works well. Yes, it does. This is the first week in which there are sections meeting. You all should know that there is a quiz at the beginning of section this week. If you are on the wait list and not yet in a section, you must be in a section to be in the course. There is room in sections. There is room in the course. There are many people who did not show up for section this week and that were registered for the course. So that means that there's probably open spaces even if the sections say they're full. What I suggest you do is go to the section that you are on the wait list for. But if you can, find a section that seems to still have open space. There are still those sections available. By next week, it'll have to be finalized, and we'll know how many spaces are available then. There should be no problem getting into this course. So if you're on a wait list, assume that you're in the course, but you must go to section. So find the section to go to. If that section is full, we may force you to move. But sections that are reasonable will still hold. As of tomorrow, I will also be posting the questions that will be for next week. Those of you who have already gone to section have noted that the quizzes have not yet covered some of the material. Some of the questions are not relevant yet because I'm going to talk about them today. And so in that respect, after today, probably almost all the questions on this week's quiz set will be available. So what that means is you show up, come with your blue book in hand, be ready to answer one or more of the questions on that question sheet. So let me just forge ahead. Today I want to pick up where I left off last time, talking about the theory of natural selection, Darwin's theory about how evolution takes place. I already mentioned that it's a theory, it's not a quote fact. Evolution itself is a fact, and I think there's plenty to back that up. How it works is still an open question, although Darwin's argument is very, very powerful, and as I'll show you today, in many ways resolves many of the questions that we had. But also, it's counterintuitive. It's misleading oftentimes to think about it as survival of the fittest, as many of you have heard before. One of the questions on the quiz is about survival of the fittest. I'll talk about that today. Many people have a misunderstanding of Darwin's theory, and part of what I want to do today is to clear some of that up. So the key to this was an insight that came to Darwin about 1838. Remember, he had been on board the British ship, the Beagle, circumnavigating the globe and analyzing plants and animals, as well as the coastline and the geography of South America. But it was some years later, as he returned, got married, settled down, began going through his notes and organizing them, beginning to think about how this process might work. The key to this is that he spent a lot of time, as many English country gentlemen did at those days, looking at issues having to do with breeding of animals and plants. This was a big project in England at the time. Many, many people were breeding plants and animals and competing for having the best plant or the best horse or the best cattle and so on and so forth. His theory of natural selection is loosely analogous to the process of selective breeding of farm animals and plants. He used this as his analogy, looking at the natural world as performing something like breeders do. However, he had a problem when thinking through this. And the problem was that at least the theories that existed up to that time, and I'll talk a little bit about that a little bit later, suggested that for traits to be passed on down, they had to be exhibited by your parents. And they had to be exhibited by your parents and interacting with the environment to respond to the environment and therefore adapt yourself to that environment and pass on that adaptation to your offspring. But he realized that there were some problems with that idea. And the main problem continued to bother him throughout his lifetime. And that had to do with bees, for example. Because bees were a problem. Only the queen bee reproduces offspring. And she doesn't ever do what workers do. Most of the bees are workers. They're out there flying, gathering pollen and so on, and they never reproduce. So the question appeared to Darwin, well, if she is the one who reproduces but never does all these other things, how does she give rise to bees that have all these other traits like workers have? Why doesn't she just give rise to bees that have male and female traits? It bothered him because this meant that those traits could never be, in effect, tested in the world. Those traits could never be adapted to the world and then passed on to offspring. Probably most people think that the insight came from talking to cattle breeders. Because cattle breeders were, of course, interested in breeding beef cattle that had particularly tasty meat. And for it to be really tasty meat, it had to be sort of marbled with fat. I won't go into all the details of that for those of you that aren't too interested in fatty meat. But in any case, Darwin was very interested in how you discern this. Because, in fact, during the life of any particular bull or whatever, you would not be able to know whether he had fatty, marbled meat. You can only tell this after the animal is dead. So how is it possible that breeders could breed for something that you only had to discover in a dead animal? How could you breed for it? And it was easy. The breeders, you know, thought this was a silly question. The answer is, you don't breed that animal. You breed its brothers and sisters or its parents. Because those traits are likely to also be carried by brothers, sisters, and parents. The result is what he realized is that, in fact, there wasn't any necessity for a trait to be tested before it was passed on. In fact, a trait could be something that was there by accident and just by virtue of being passed on by accident, it would get maintained. It wasn't necessary to have the cause precede the consequence. In effect, the consequence could be passed on because it was passed on by your brothers and sisters. Darwin, in 1838, tried to lay out the argument for this, a kind of a logical argument. And in his 1838 notebook, he has three lines. He says, you know, these three things will explain it all. Grandchildren are like grandfathers. In other words, there's some similarity in traits passed down generation to generation. There's a tendency to small change, especially with physical change. That is, parents and offspring are like each other, but they're not identical. There's lots of variety that comes up. And finally, he said, there's great fertility in proportion to the support of the parents. In other words, this came from his thinking about the problem that was brought up before, a generation before, by Malthus, Thomas Malthus, who we talked about last time, who argued that, in fact, reproduction always outpaces the resources available. And as a result, there's always some competition. Some individuals never grow up. Some individuals have very little reproduction, produce very few offspring, and so on. Some die at an early age. Darwin realized that this was going to be true in nature. He said, you put these three things together, and what you're going to get is adaptation to the world. Now, let me give you a restatement that took these same ideas and restated them roughly 150 years later. And this is by a man named Richard Lewontin, a fairly famous modern evolutionary biologist. He said these three things can be described as heritability, inheriting traits. Today we know of this as a genetic process. We pass on genes from parents to offspring. Individual variations, the result of mother and father's genes recombining, you get different combinations of traits in the offspring, but you also can get errors, mutations, in which those genetic traits get modified. So children are not exactly like their parents. They have a different mix, and they may have genes that none of their parents have actually had because of these changes. And then finally, there's overreproduction of offspring, which leads to differences in the survival and the future reproduction of those individuals. These three rules describe the basic logic of natural selection. If you inherit your traits, if there's variation in those traits in the next generation, and if there's always overreproduction, too many babies born in a particular cohort, a particular generation, Not all of them will make it to be reproducers themselves. The consequence is those that are better suited to the environment they've appeared in, for whatever reasons, whether by virtue of what their parents are doing or just by the accident of getting a certain particular combination of genes, will do better at reproducing and tend to pass on their traits. This, Darwin realized, would explain in a very simple way, without making a lot of assumptions, how organisms became fitted or adapted to their environments. So Darwin's theory was about adaptation, how things became fitted to their environment, and therefore also how organisms changed over time in evolution. So it's kind of like a recipe, and I want to lay it out as a recipe, in part because it's not really a mechanism in the way we think about it. It's not really a mechanism about X happened, then Y happened, then Z happened. It's not mechanical in the same sense. It's more like an algorithm or a recipe. So here's the parts of it. The cause of a current trait. The cause of a trait that exists now is the beneficial effect that it had in some previous generation or generations. So the traits that I carry now are here because they had a beneficial effect in the past, not necessarily now. Effects that aid the reproduction of their causes, that is, in this case, of their genes, help to preserve those same mechanisms, those same genes, or those same developmental mechanisms in the next generation. So simply by having been useful in the past, it tends to get passed on. Natural selection is therefore agnostic about what mechanisms make it possible. In other words, it doesn't matter why a particular trait got passed on, why it was beneficial. It could be beneficial for lots of different reasons, even accidentally beneficial. It would get passed on preferentially because of this. So the mechanism doesn't matter. In a sense, it's agnostic. It doesn't really care about how it happened. For this reason, Darwin could make this claim without knowing anything about how traits actually get passed on. Darwin knew nothing about the genetics we know about today. He only knew that grandchildren were like grandfathers. There was a tendency for similarity and a tendency for variation. But because his theory didn't depend on any particular mechanism, just the statistical kind of logic, it could work even despite that. Natural selection is therefore more like a general recipe for these properties and how they came about. And it's a recipe for what kind of mechanism, and I say here a blind mechanism, that is a mechanism that's not trying to be adapted to the world, but just some mechanism that produced something that in generation one was appropriate to that context, that will tend to pass that same mechanism, those same genes, that same information on to the next generation. So what this will produce is fittedness to the environment even by accident, because it remembers those accidents. I like to compare this to your use of computers and the data that you have and the disks and the chips and so on. We're always warned that we should back up our data. How many of you have had a disk or a computer fail on you and you've lost data because of it? Well, it goes down every year. That means we're getting more reliable. It does happen. And the reason for that is quite simple. Hard disks or whatever we use are physical objects that degrade over time. Eventually, everything will fail. Whatever hard disk you're using now isn't going to be working 50 years from now. I guarantee that. The same thing with magnetic recording that you have. Very little of it will last the decades. How do we keep it going? Well, we back it up. We make copies. Things naturally tend to fall apart. And the more complicated something is, the more likely it's to wear out and to fail. Why? Because there's many parts that can go wrong. So the more complicated something is, and of course life is very complicated, so how do we keep traits in the world? How do we keep good traits from being lost? Well, the answer is you make multiple copies. How do you keep some paper that you've really liked or some song that you've downloaded that you really like? Eventually it's going to go bad. You might better make copies of it and store those copying. The problem is, however, copying is never perfect. This is another problem of the media that we use, is they're physical. Things go wrong. Things don't always copy exactly. So not only is the storage mechanism problematic, the copying process can be problematic too. And once in a while, errors will show up. Now, many of you probably had syllabi or other things that were Xeroxed. And in a class of this size, we oftentimes Xerox hundreds of things. By the 100th or 200th copy, oftentimes you see that it's slightly degraded. And it's particularly degraded if you copy a copy and then copy a copy of a copy and copy a copy of a copy. Why? Because every little speck of dust on the screen also gets copied. And eventually, if you copy copies and copy copies and copies copies and so on, eventually the image gets more and more degraded. Now, it's better now than when I was a young student. We used to have these things called mimeo machines. You had to crank, and they used ink, and the ink got run out, and it got messy and got dim and so on. Things get better. Our copying systems are better, but still there's variation. Copying also takes time and energy, and there's only so much time and energy. So how many of you have not backed up your hard disk in the last year? Ah, I bet more of you should raise your hands. I'm one of those, by the way. Because of the time and energy, the hassle it takes, you sort of say, oh, I can wait a little bit longer. It takes effort to do it. And copying processes, some will be better than others. The nice thing about computers these days is we've got really easy copying. When I first started school, I was a lousy typist, and I had papers that I wrote by longhand and had somebody retype. And then I had to find the typos and have them retyped again. It was a terrible process. Now it's easier to make copies. That helps a lot, too. And in fact, what that means is things that have to be copied by hand are copied less effectively than things that can be copied electronically. But even the printing press is an example of this. Showing up for the first time, we had an ability to repeatedly produce exactly the same text over and over again without having to write each character one after another. So before the printing press, of course, everything was done copying by hand. Errors accumulated. You couldn't make enough copies of a thing so that only a very few people would have access to it. With the dawn of the printing age, it became possible for average people to have copies of books like the Bible and so on. And finally, surrounding conditions are going to favor the production and the persistence of some kinds of copies more than others, things that are more appropriate to the environment. You can imagine that if there was suddenly a terrible disaster and all of electrical grids went down, guess what? All that stuff you've been doing such a great job of copying and backing up and so on, totally inaccessible. Things have to be appropriate to their environment, and the environment can change. And as a result, copies don't happen. I like to think about, you know, the first of these rules is that accidents and decay just happen. That's the second law of thermodynamics in action. And so we make copies, we reproduce as biological organisms. But there's some of those reproduced bits of information are damaged or modified. Those are mutations. Since it takes time and energy to do that, there's competition in evolution. Organisms are competing for resources, just like your time is limited by the fact of other things that are competing for your time and energy and maybe buying backup disks and that sort of thing. The number of copies you produce, how many copies you have, how many backups is pretty important, but think about it in terms of the difference between the printing press and doing things by hand. Suddenly, one is more successful at reproducing. It can reproduce really fast and really effectively. And very, very quickly, the printing press, of course, replaced copying things by hand. And finally, systems of copying and maintaining information that are appropriate to their environment, can resist problems like loss of electricity, in effect, are more likely to be passed on in the future. If we human beings pass through a phase of disaster, a kind of a dark age, guess what? The books will outlast the computer information. paper does a better job. We've had paper around for thousands of years. And in fact, stuff that's carved in stone even longer. Those are the things that will last. So there are things that have to do, that persistence also has to do with the environment that things show up in. That's adaptation. Some people have talked about evolution as just remembering good accidents. And that's one way to think about it. Natural selection is about remembering good accidents. An accident happens to change the way an organism works. And if, by chance, it fits appropriately in the world, it will be retained. So it's sometimes even been called the law of effect. That is, the consequence is what drives it, not something that happened beforehand. Mutation that happened, a change, a random variation of something, doesn't guarantee that it fits or that it works in the world. It's just something that happens by accident. But lucky accidents, if they get remembered, if they get reproduced, will then be appropriate to their world. So some people have described this problem as simply randomly generating sequences of things. It's not quite that bad, luckily. But ask yourself this question. Could 1,000 apes typing randomly for 1,000 years ever produce this particular sentence? The answer is there's not too many letters here. The combinations are immense, but 1,000 apes typing 1,000 pages a day maybe could produce this sentence. It's not outlandish, but still it's very, very unlikely. Evolution has to be probably better than this. It has to do a better job of remembering. But if each time the ape typed a word that was a true English word, and from that point on, every time you type the first letter of that word, or the first two letters, it would produce the whole word, sort of like some of the things that automatically happen in computers these days or on your cell phones. What happens is it decreases the errors, but it increases the ability of passing that on forward, remembering good combinations. So if the apes had some way of remembering good combinations, so every time they typed in a good word, a real English word, it would remember that English word and maybe a new key would show up on the keyboard that had that English word as its only output, that would make it much, much more likely. And so remembering good accidents really increases the probability of coming up with, say, a sentence like this. A man named Donald Campbell described natural selection with what I think is a very nice sort of epigraph. He said it's blind variation with selective retention. The variations happen at chance. But if those that work are selectively retained, it will increase the probability that things get better over time, that things get more fitted to their environments over time. I use the term fittedness here. I'm going to give you a sort of another way to think about it in a minute. Fittedness is like clothing that fits you. Organisms fit their environment in this sense. But fitness has taken on another meaning in biology, and I'll talk about it in a minute. Darwin had, in fact, in his work and The Origin of Species, only one diagram, and I reproduce it here, because it tells you a little bit about what he was really after. He was after two things. The idea of descent, the idea that all organisms on Earth descended from parents and ancestors all the way back, that diverged and diverged and diverged in traits, that there were common ancestors to what are today diverse species. That is, they all came from a common ancestor, but those offspring became more and more different over time. So this is his diagram, a sort of a tree diagram, of a lineage of species starting at the bottom with a common ancestor. They give rise to lots of variants, but only a couple of them make it. Who give rise to a bunch of variants, but only one of those makes it, and so on and so forth to produce this kind of a tree. So these species over here now in the present might be quite different in all of their traits, because at each step, new changes took place and were retained. And this gives rise to this notion that we talked about in the first lecture, the distinction between homologous and analogous in biology. So here is one of my favorite pictures. This is actually, hard to believe, an ad for Chrysler Corporation that I found a number of years ago. Now, if you can figure out why the Chrysler Corporation, the car corporation, used this ad, you're better off than me. But in any case, this was this sort of solidarity of species. I thought it was such a great picture. But you'll notice something interesting. All of these guys that are numbered that you can see here are homologous to each other. They all descend from a common ancestor. They don't look much alike. They do very different things. You can fly with it, with this limb. You can run fast with this limb. You can swim with this limb. You can type on a computer with this limb. What's interesting is if you were to look inside at the skeletons of these, and we'll talk about this a little bit later in the course, the skeletons look much more similar than they do externally. These are all homologous. They all have the form they have because they came from a common ancestor. So if I back up here, a common ancestor gave rise to a bunch of separate lineages that have very separate features, but because they have a common ancestry, they also have some deep similarities. Darwin came up with the phrase for this. He said that evolution is descent with modification. So there's two things that Darwin was about. He was about explaining descent with modification, how species became different from each other, and also adaptation, how species fit with their world. But he did not try to explain how they reproduce, how their metabolism works, nor did he even try to explain the origins of life, because life didn't initially evolve. Evolution happened after life appeared. So Darwin was only really talking about these two features, descent with modification and adaptation. I should say that there is one outlier here. It doesn't have a number here. It actually has a dark number in it. This is a limb of a species that is not homologous with any of these others. It does similar things. It can grasp onto things. It can help this organism locomote and move around. But it does not have a common ancestral structure. This did not come from a vertebrate. This is an invertebrate, obviously an octopus tentacle. This has analogous functions. It can grasp like the hand could grasp, for example. But it is not homologous. It is not a result of descent with modification. All of the rest descended from a common form and were modified step by step by step. Now, this logic applies elsewhere. And one of my favorite examples, this was pulled out of the San Francisco Chronicle about a decade ago, but I thought it was so curious that I had to utilize it. So this is a design that many of you may have seen. These are things that you stick on the back of your car to sort of tell the world something about yourself. This fish, which comes from an ancient Christian saying where Jesus asks his disciples to be fishers of men, the fish actually represented one of the early signs for the Christian church. And so in modern times, it was reappropriated to indicate that the person driving this car is a Christian. Now, oftentimes, you put this on the back of your car because if you're really fundamentalist about Christianity, you may have some doubts or dislike about the theory of evolution. But what's interesting is that there were a couple of lineages that developed. Descent with modification took place here. This is an interesting one over here. This says ichthys, which is the Greek for fish. This was also used as a Christian saying. And you can see, so here we see the Christian side of the evolutionary ladder. And here we see Jesus inside this one. The Jesus fish is now altered and evolved to one that actually says Jesus. And then I like this one here. This one is trust, eating. What's he eating over here? I don't know if you can read it on here. I can't even read it. Darwin. Oh, it's eating the Darwin fish. Now, interestingly enough, this is the Darwin fish here. The truth is eating the Darwin fish over here. So you can see that this one evolved by descent and modification. This one also evolved by descent and modification in some more interesting ways. Lutefisk, of course, is a kind of fish dish. Sushi, of course, a fish dish. And then finally, and chips. You don't even have to mention fish up here. And then, of course, there's the lineage that was fighting against, reacting against the Christian reaction. So you put Darwin in here, Darwin fish, and you got to put a couple of feet on here, fish coming up to land. And then being a little bit more serious about it, it's not just Darwin, it's evolving. And there's a little tool out here, you know, really going ahead. I don't know what's happened to the fish since this time, but there's probably been more of an evolution of these fish. But notice that this is something that happens also culturally. These didn't happen by accident. These are all, of course, designs. People did this on purpose. But in Darwin's view, it doesn't matter whether it's an accident or done on purpose. Descent with modification. Somebody creates this, and if it fills a need and gets people interested and they buy it up, they'll reproduce it. So it's reproduction, whether, you know, on purpose or by accident, that produces this descent with modification. My favorite examples, however, come from something that is no longer done on paper, but it's nice to go back to those good old paper and typewriter days to look at chain letters. Now, there are things like chain letters that show up on computers. We have even computer viruses that evolve. But this is a nice one because it gives you quite a sense of all the details. I have to put on my glasses to see this. Hopefully you can see some of the details. The original letter is here in black. And I'll just leave this for you to look at over time. These are all the changes that happened over time. And so you can see there's some interesting things. So here, the name here changes again and again and again, this person's name, because, you know, Carl, Carol, Carlos, or whomever, Charles, it doesn't matter whose name is here, really. So this is pretty much changing by random, but notice it's changing a little bit at a time. Daddy, all of these, just slight changes, but these are the result of typos. The problem with the chain letter in the days of typewriters was that you got one chain letter and you're supposed to produce 20 more and send them out to your friends. How did you do it? Well, you typed it. But of course, typos would sneak in. But there's more than just typos here. Notice something interesting here. Here's the effect of what you could get if you did it right. Notice that over time, and this is the time sequence going down, is that the rewards get bigger and the costs, if not doing it, the consequences get bigger over time. And that's a real problem. Then, of course, there was the Christian version in which they inserted a verse from Matthew, St. Matthew, in the preamble, and that sped it up. Each of these, my guess is that these probably had not much difference, but as you began to increase the numbers and, you know, things that could go bad, if the letter, chain letter is broken, what could happen to you? What terrible things, will befall you? These things could actually enhance its reproduction. Because in an environment where people are worried about getting more money, if it's worth more, I better reproduce it. Or if the consequences, if five people have died who didn't reproduce the chain letter, boy, I better do it to avoid that. So chain letters will evolve to fit the environment. Now, what's their environment? It's you and me. It's our worries. It's our fears. It's our desires. We're the environment that these chain letters were reproduced in. See here. Oh, there I see it. This is the phylogeny, that is the descent history, the descent with modification of those chain letters. I put these both here because you can go back to this and sort of look at these changes. And each of these changes, as you go down from top to bottom, represents one of these changes. So you can see it produces a lineage. A descent with modification lineage, and here you see the things being kicked in here. All things, the love in the title, St. Jude and money showing up here, a bunch of these. This is an example of a kind of evolutionary process. It's a little bit like natural selection. Obviously, it's not the same, but it's descent with modification, with mutations, with differential reproduction as a result of how it fits in the environment. The environment of people exchanging these letters. Now, Darwin's idea of natural selection wasn't the only way that people thought about how species evolved. And so I want to talk a little bit about some other views, but also to make it clear ways that it doesn't work, ways in which evolution doesn't work, and yet are common fallacies and confusions about the notion of evolution. I noted last time that Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace basically came up with this idea about the same time. But about the same time he was writing, this man, Herbert Spencer, was also writing. And in fact, his name does not appear in theories of evolution these days. And in fact, even in the late 19th century, when a notion of social evolution, like I was just sort of giving you some examples of a social evolutionary process, Spencer came up with a whole variety of ideas about social evolution, and they became known as social Darwinism. They, in fact, were mostly wrong and misleading. I'll talk about that shortly. But Spencer's name didn't get stuck with it. Darwin's name did. And it was, in fact, one of the reasons why many people in the social sciences began to ignore and avoid thinking about biological evolution having anything to do with cultural processes. Herbert Spencer actually coined the phrase survival of the fittest, not Darwin. And as you know, that's one of the questions I ask on the quiz. But it's very important that I come back to that in a few minutes. On this side of the boundary is a man named August Weismann. Weismann was actually the guy who finally repudiated Jean-Baptiste de Lamarck's theory of evolution, in which you acquire characteristics during your lifespan and pass them on to your offspring. He basically showed that that doesn't happen, that in fact the sperm and egg that give rise to a fertilized ovum and eventually become a new baby, a new organism, never were part of the rest of your body, never got information about whether you got stronger or weaker, whether you got sick, whether you learned algebra or not. None of that stuff got into the sperm and egg that got passed on. He called this the sequestered germline. The germline refers to those cells, the germ cells as they're sometimes called, the sperm and the egg. He basically says that they're sequestered away from the rest of the body. They're produced right after the initial reproduction takes place, and they don't interact with the other cells of your body. And so there's no way that they could get information about whether you were exercising or not, and so on. And finally, a man named Ernst Haeckel, whom I'll talk about in a minute as well, came up with another theory that is no longer recognized, a theory about how evolution might be a kind of progress. On this side of the divide, these guys both thought of evolution as progress. Darwin did not think of evolution as progress, nor did Weismann. So let me talk a little bit about Herbert Spencer, because he was actually at the time, in many ways, at least as influential, at least in Britain, as was Charles Darwin. He had written about the cosmos and how the solar system changed over time, used the term evolution, the solar system evolved, societies evolved, organisms evolved, minds evolved. Evolution was everywhere for Herbert Spencer. Herbert Spencer, however, was a Lamarckian. He thought that everything was the result of a kind of use and inheritance. You use it during one generation, build up a response, and that's inherited by your offspring. He believed that learned habits could be passed on by reproduction. And this is what led to this notion of social Darwinism. Social progress, he thought, could lead to biological progress if it produced habits. So you grew up in a certain environment, you develop certain habits of behavior that you don't have to even think about. Those habits get built into your body, so to speak. If what's built into your body gets passed on to your offspring, then the things that you acquire during your life will show up in the offspring. He then argued from this that primitive societies, so-called, societies that did not have the kinds of laws and occupations and learning and so on that you find, for example, in industrial England in the 19th century, were not passing on these habits. because they were not acquiring those habits. As a result, it suggested to him that people in these so-called, quote, primitive societies were not as biologically evolved either. So Herbert Spencer created this sort of hierarchy of more evolved and less evolved people, more evolved and less evolved societies. We still sometimes hear people talking about evolution, you know, more evolved being somehow better. This is a holdover from this late 19th century idea. But if Lamarckian inheritance doesn't work, as it was refuted at the end of the 19th century, then all of this falls apart. So in the early 20th century, when not Darwin's ideas, but Spencer's ideas were quite dominant in talking about societies and differences between cultures and the world, a lot of very sensible anthropologists beginning to create a sociology and an anthropology that fitted the world that they came upon, recognized that this couldn't be true, and that people were roughly equivalently evolved irrespective of their societies. That it was, in effect, the evolution of the technology, perhaps, in those places that differed different people, not anything about their biology. Darwin himself recognized this as well, but wasn't sure. Darwin wasn't sure, and wasn't sure that Spencer was wrong or that Lamarck was wrong, because he had, again, no theory of how traits get passed on. He did not understand this sequestering of the germline. And so he wasn't sure that this couldn't be true, but in his trip around the world, he became quite convinced that the people living in the south tip of South America, Tierra del Fuego, who were mostly naked, had very, very simple technologies, were yet capable of learning the King's English, so to speak, of learning modern manners. Some of these people were actually brought back to England. Darwin was very much convinced that their moral and intellectual stature was equivalent to people that he had already met. So Darwin was doubtful of this, but did not have a mechanism to demonstrate it. This notion still reigns. Herbert Spencer's phrase, survival of the fittest, was not in the early editions of Darwin's Origin of Species. It only shows up in later editions. Darwin was urged to put it in there because it seemed to be so convincing as a kind of epigraph to explain how this works. But think about the two terms, survival and fittest. They can be very misleading if you think about the way I described natural selection just a minute ago. Because to be fit can be interpreted to refer to being, for example, healthy, strong, long-lived, beautiful, handsome, whatever. Those are the fit ones. According to Herbert Spencer, if you had any of these traits, you would tend to pass it on to your offspring. If you were physically fit, they would be more physically fit, and so on. According to Darwin's theory, and especially as it was developed later after Darwin's time by people like Weismann and others, and what's sometimes come to be called neo-Darwinism, Darwinism, in effect, after genetics, that neo-Darwinism thought that this kind of feature was irrelevant for evolution. All that really matters, like with the chain letters, was how effectively things get reproduced. It's not whether it's better written or the typeface is a better typeface. It's simply, does it get reproduced or not? But as a result, the term fitness has persisted in the history of evolutionary biology. And I wanted to spend just a minute to give you a sense of how to think about this. Fitness is not, then, a measure of health, strength, longevity, or any other feature of the organism, but how many babies you produce. What's happened is the concept of fitness has, in contemporary terminology, begun to refer to what we sometimes call reproductive success. An individual that's more fit is one that produces more babies, and therefore is reproducing more of the traits that it carries that will be more likely to persist in the future. Fitness, then, doesn't have anything to do with fitting in any obvious sense. And yet, if you've reproduced more effectively than anybody else, it's typically because you're better fitted to the world that you're living in. You have more access to resources. You've lived long enough to produce healthy babies. They don't get sick, and so on. So fitness and what I call fittedness, my term, are related to each other. But fitness today is simply a measure of reproductive success. And therefore, it's considered to be an indirect measure of how fitted or how adapted an organism is, even though it's not actually measuring how they're adapted, what kind of adaptation, how do they fit with the world. It's simply saying, what are the consequences of being fitted with the world? But remember again, that's the logic of Darwin. The consequences are what matters. How you got there doesn't matter. How you were fitted doesn't matter. The fact that you did better than others is what matters. Now, there's an old joke, my favorite joke about this, that captures the idea quite clearly. Two guys are out camping, and they're cooking up breakfast. Smells really good out in the campfire. Suddenly, they see a grizzly bear running after them. And one guy turns to the other and he says, "Oh, we're doomed. The grizzly bear can outrun either of us. None of us can outrun the grizzly bear." And the other guy, probably a biologist, turns to him and he says, "Yes, but I can outrun you." That's the logic. It doesn't matter whether you're able to outrun a bear. It matters whether you can outrun your competitors, so to speak. So let me begin with a little story. How many have seen this movie? Okay, I think it does a great job of getting this idea across, and so I can't help but show it to you. Okay, here we go. This is not the whole movie, by the way. This is just the intro.
As the 21st century began, human evolution was at a turning point. Natural selection, the process by which the strongest, the smartest, the fastest reproduced in greater numbers than the rest, a process which had once favored the noblest traits of man, now began to favor different traits. Most science fiction of the day predicted a future that was more civilized and more intelligent. But as time went on, things seemed to be heading in the opposite direction, a dumbing down. How did this happen? Evolution does not necessarily reward intelligence. With no natural predators to thin the herd, it began to simply reward those who reproduced the most and left the intelligent to become an endangered species.
Having kids is such an important decision.
We're just waiting for the right time. It's not something you want to rush into, obviously.
No way.
Oh, shit, I'm pregnant again!
I got too many damn kids. Thought you was on the pill or some shit.
Hell no.
Must have been thinking of Brittany.
Brittany? No, you can't. There's no way we could have a child now. Mm-mm. Not with the market the way it is, no.
God, no. That just wouldn't make any sense.
Come on over here, bitch! He don't care about you.
Yeah, well, there must be something he likes over here.
You mean nothing to me, baby?
It wasn't me! It wasn't me!
Well, we finally decided to have children, and I'm not pointing fingers, but it's not going well.
And this is helping.
I'm just saying that before I have in vitro, maybe you should be willing to...
It's always me, right?
Well, it's not my sperm count.
Yeah! Yeah! I'm gonna fuck all of y'all! Yep, my boy!
Cleavon is lucky to be alive. He attempted to jump a jet ski from a lake into a swimming pool and impaled his crotch on an iron gate. But thanks to recent advances in stem cell research and the fine work of Doctors Krensky and Altshuler, Cleavon should regain full reproductive function.
Get your hands off my junk!
Unfortunately, Trevor passed away from a heart attack while masturbating to produce sperm for artificial insemination. But I have some eggs frozen. So just as soon as the right guy comes along, you know.
And so it went for generations, although few, if any, seemed to notice.
All right. That gets the idea across, I think. So, not progress, not things necessarily getting better. Evolution is not about things getting better, about organisms getting smarter or living longer or whatever. Evolution is about how things get fitted to their context. Some of that context involves other organisms, of course, so it's a pretty complicated story. Let me talk about Ernst Haeckel, one of these other guys. Ernst Haeckel's idea was a kind of progress idea. He argued that evolution and development both express tendencies towards greater complexity. In fact, many people in thinking about evolution have thought about evolution as a tendency for things to get more complex, that evolution is about a complexification process. He argued that as organisms develop, they get more complex. So maybe evolution is just a variation on the development of organisms, in which it's gone on, in a sense, because since development is adding new complexity, evolution might be adding new complexity. He actually argued that humans were, in fact, the most complex. We got, you know, we're smarter than all these other guys and so on. Bacteria at the bottom. He had a kind of a tree version of this, of the story. You see a lot of sort of tree diagrams of evolutionary processes. As you move up the tree, of course, there's side branches, but there's at the top of the tree and the bottom of the tree. Bacteria are the simplest. We're presumably the most complex. The problem with this idea is that really we're not more evolved in some sense than even the bacteria. Bacteria that are here today have been around since the beginning. They have been evolving. They have ancestors that go back as far as our ancestors do. Chimpanzees, the same. The result is, there really is not a hierarchy here. Evolution is not linear. It's not necessarily progressive. But it does tend to diversify, and it expands into novel niches. Today there are fishes that have antifreeze in their blood, for example, that can live in Arctic waters. This wasn't the case in the recent past. But one of the diverse areas in which evolution has generated unique features is animals with antifreeze in their blood. There are bacteria and deep sea organisms that can live in volcanic vents or near volcanic vents where the temperatures are boiling, in effect, that would destroy most organisms. They've adapted to this extreme environment. There are insects, like ants, for example, that have adapted to all different kinds of environments. In fact, probably the biggest biomass on Earth, that is the biggest, if you were to weigh all the members of a group, are the ants. Ants really are incredibly profligate in terms of numbers of individuals, vastly, vastly outnumbering almost all other animals on the planet. Now, there is a case to be made that we are an extreme example as well. We have gone in a different kind of extreme. We have an extreme having to do with our nervous system. We have pretty big brains, not the biggest on the planet, but they're pretty darn big, and they do things that others don't do. Evolution, and Stephen Jay Gould, an evolutionary thinker from the last generation, argued that evolution is not a tree, it's a bush, he says. And the bush is such that it grows out in all directions. Organisms are diversifying in all directions to occupy newer and newer niches over time. One reason, however, that things have gotten more complex over evolutionary time, over the last 3.5 billion years that life has been on the Earth, is that living things can't get much simpler and still be alive. Think about it. Bacteria are really stripped down. You know, minimal number of genes, minimal size. They use other organisms to reproduce so they can give up a lot of their reproductive apparatus. They can be pretty darn simple. But you can't get too simple. You can't be as simple as a sugar molecule and still be alive. The story with life is that there's a barrier at the low end, at the simple end. Things can't get much simpler and still be alive. So even though evolution is working like a bush in all directions, it's blocked from getting simpler. But it's not blocked from getting more complex. So over time, even if what we see is that it's just sort of a bell curve of complexity, more complex and less complex, as that bell curve enlarges, as there's more diversity and more kinds of organisms, it's natural that we're going to see some that over time are more complex than others. There's no upper limit to how complex things can be, but there is a lower limit. So just by randomly making things more and less complex, things will tend to get more complex over time. So there is a kind of tendency, but it's not the tendency that's internal to natural selection. It's just simply the result of this complexity limitation. The result is that we've got to get rid of thinking about evolution as a kind of striving to do better. Here's one of my favorite cartoonists. I'll use a lot of his cartoons as we go along. This is Larson's Far Side. Here he's talking about, he says, another great moment in evolution. Little fish here hanging out, suddenly jumps over and then goes back into the water. The idea that somehow these guys, these little lungfish, are actually starting to become land adapted. Organisms aren't striving to become different or new or better. Organisms are striving to stay alive long enough to reproduce. And when things change, they've got to adapt or not reproduce. These little guys, these little mud skippers, are out of the water not because they're trying to become land creatures. It's because being in the water in these conditions will kill you. It's because their gills no longer can extract enough oxygen from this water that's become highly brackish. And so what they do instead is swallow air and hold air long enough to get a little bit of the oxygen from the air, long enough for them to survive, to typically go from a pond that's got less oxygen to a pond that's got more oxygen. Helps them survive to reproduce. They're not trying to become land animals. They're trying to stay fish. We sometimes get lost in thinking about evolution as competition between species. Darwin was not actually talking about competition between species. He was talking about competition that goes on within species. That evolution does cause species to disappear and new species to show up, but not because species are competing with each other. So one of the stories that was often told about the dinosaurs historically was that the dinosaurs all died out because mammals were somehow better adapted. Mammals were a better organism than dinosaurs. Well, if that was the case, mammals should have long ago replaced the dinosaurs. Dinosaurs hung around for a couple hundred million years and were doing quite well, and mammals basically didn't get out of their holes and didn't get out of nocturnal life for the most part. They were small, diminutive little creatures. But what happened apparently is that the climate changed so radically, so suddenly, that this terrific adaptation that the dinosaurs had was no longer effective. They were replaced not because mammals were better than they were, but that mammals could survive the catastrophe that caused the dinosaurs to die out, probably by darkening the planet, causing plants to die, causing organisms to freeze to death, and so on. Mammals that had been living underground, had been burrowing, had fur, had internal metabolism that slowed down their growth because most of their energy was put into staying warm instead of growing. So they couldn't grow fast to compete with the dinosaurs. But they could hang out at night when dinosaurs couldn't, because dinosaurs needed the heat of the day. As a result, when the Earth apparently cooled way down and it became hard to make it, some mammals persisted where most of the dinosaurs disappeared. It wasn't because mammals were a better design. Mammals were just simply, by the luck of the draw, able to survive this particular catastrophe. So evolution is not the replacement of one species by another species. And finally, there's what I call the Planet of the Apes fallacy. These movies have become very popular. And the story about the Planet of the Apes, of course, many of you know, maybe all of you know, is that somehow human beings degraded somehow, but apes continued to evolve. And eventually they developed language and a culture, and they became the dominant race on the planet. chimpanzees and gorillas aren't striving to become human. Humans aren't the goal of evolution. Being smarter is not the goal. Chimpanzees are being really good at what they're doing. They're good at living in the habitat that they live in, eating the kinds of foods that are available there, reproducing well. They're not in a race to catch up to humans. I mentioned last time that some veterinarian years ago wrote me saying that the disproof of evolution is that chimpanzees are still around. Well, chimpanzees weren't competing with us. We weren't racing to see who got to be more human first. They became chimpanzees. They were around. They've been around as long as we have. We did share a common ancestor, interestingly enough. We did not replace or improve upon them. We just evolved to a different kind of environment in a different way. So let me now talk a little bit about ways of thinking about natural selection. Because we normally think about natural selection with a kind of a progress frame of mind. And that's a misnomer. It's dangerous to think about evolution as progress. Nevertheless, there are changes in evolution that cause organisms to change from time to time to become different. That was critical to the descent with modification theory that Darwin presented. We call this kind of evolution directional selection. Selection that doesn't favor individuals at one end of a bell curve of variation, but does favor those at this end. So think about height. And one of the examples I give in your problems for this week have to do with birth size of children. Children that are very small at birth typically don't survive. Those that are very large at birth typically don't survive. The birth process selectively favors individuals of an intermediate range of sizes. The result is that there's not much transmission of traits for giving birth to small babies or very, very large babies, because those babies mostly don't survive. Some of them maybe do. But over time, that means if you're culling at both ends of the size spectrum, eventually the range of sizes is going to get smaller, and it's going to be stabilized. So this is oftentimes called stabilizing selection. Natural selection is not selecting for us to have bigger and bigger and bigger noses, but noses within a certain size range, ears within a certain size range. And the fact that there's variation tells you that it's not a precisely restricted size range. There still is a bell curve of variation, but it's pretty modest. We don't find human beings very often with huge ears as big as their heads or with tiny, tiny or huge noses either. This is stabilizing selection. Most natural selection is probably stabilizing selection. Things mostly stay the same. But when conditions change, sometimes only the small, for example, get selected against. In that case, the bell curve shifts, and the average, in this case, becomes larger. So, for example, as the Earth cools during ice ages, animals living in northern climates that are larger, that grow to larger size, tend to hold their heat better, tend to not need to eat as much to produce the same amount of heat. And so there's selection against the smaller animals favoring the larger ones, and on average, the species get larger. We see this in the history of many mammals in northern climates, is that over the course of evolutionary history, they tend to enlarge, get larger and larger and larger. There's another one that I'll talk about that's a little harder to get a sense of, but I'll try to give you a sense of it. It's called disruptive selection. Disruptive selection is selection in which the average is at a disadvantage. You might imagine a territory that has dark, shadowy places and light sand, like out in the desert. If you're a little mouse and you're bright colored like the sand, you can be camouflaged out there. Or if you're dark-colored, like the shadowed areas, like the burrows and under rocks and so on, you'll be okay. But if you're halfway in between, if you're a compromise, you're no good in either of those spots. Predators will pick you off. That means that it may produce, even within a single species, individuals that are either dark or light, but not in between. That's selection against the intermediate trait, the average trait, or the trait in between two extremes. Now, it turns out that there are some interesting examples of this that we don't normally think about in these terms. We'll come back to this later in the course. This is something that Darwin also began to think about. Darwin called this sexual selection, but it's a kind of disruptive selection within a species. These are two Chinese pheasants fighting with each other. They are males, obviously males. Bright red, bright coloration, and if you look at their talons, they have long, sharp talons. In fact, they have this talon on the back of their leg that's like a knife, incredibly sharp, and they attack each other with it. They're fighting over territory and eventually fighting over females. Disruptive selection here is at work because if you learn to look at the females, they are not brightly colored. They're well camouflaged. They don't have these knives on their legs, and they don't engage in fighting all the time like these males do. They spend all their time, of course, caring for offspring. What's happened here is that selection has, within one species, and we're one of these examples, has selected two body types that are quite different, that do very different things. There are a number of species that if you look at them, you couldn't tell males from females. But there are other species, like these pheasants and like you and I, where it's somewhat easier to see who's a male and who's a female, because traits have been selected so that everybody doesn't have the average trait. Everybody has one or the others of two extremes of body types. The sex differences that make some species, males and females, very different from each other and other species not so different from each other have to do with this presence or absence of disruptive selection, selection against the average, because there somehow is a favoring. Individuals that have all of these traits are going to be lousy for raising offspring because they'll give away the place where they're raising their offspring. Predators will eat them. And in fact, they don't look like they'd be very good caretakers either because they're always feisty. And vice versa for the females. So this is disruptive selection. And here's one of my other favorite examples of these sexual differences. And oops, didn't mean to do that. Let's see, get these off. There we go. This is a frigate bird. This is the male, and you'll see the females in a minute.
Their visual signal is normally an inconspicuous patch of shriveled skin on the throat. It takes about 20 minutes to blow one up. The females, who don't have a throat pouch, cruise by, assessing what is on offer. The size of the balloon gives them a good indication of a male's vigour, and therefore his desirability as father of their chicks. A female takes a closer look. Males who haven't yet got a nest keep a close eye on developments. The female leaves, and one of the homeless males decides to make a challenge. The throat pouch is an obvious target. Tear that, and its owner won't be able to attract anyone. A new proprietor takes over the nest site and pumps up his balloon. Su- success is swift. She's found what she was looking for.
So this is what Darwin called sexual selection. I'll have more to say about this a little bit later. But you can see what's happened here is that the selection forces at work are different on males and females. And here, males and females are actually introducing some of those factors. Males that can't fight off another male that's trying to rip its throat pouch, in effect, will lose out and not reproduce. So that even within the species, you provide some of the effects of natural selection. In this case, disruptive natural selection or sexual selection. Finally, something that's important to recognize, and it's sometimes been called the Red Queen effect. You remember from Alice Through the Looking Glass that the Red Queen, if those of you who know this story, grabs Alice, and the world is zooming by, and the Red Queen says, sometimes you just say, you have to keep running as fast as you can to keep up. And so if they run fast enough, the world is stable. But they have to keep running in order for the world to be stable, because the world is zooming by. Evolution is kind of like this. Because it's not only the physical world, but also other animals and plants in the world, that they themselves are also evolving and adapting and trying to out-reproduce their neighbors and so on. The world is constantly in flux. It's constantly changing. And remember, an adaptation that's inherited in this generation was inherited because it worked in the past generations. But that doesn't mean it's ideally suited to the present. That also means that there can be circumstances in which what worked in the past doesn't work in the future. New things will now work. Some things may not work at all. Extinction may be the consequence. So an adaptation doesn't mean things work now even. And that'll be an issue for you and I. Do our adaptations work now? They worked in the past. And finally, there are interactions between species in which species try to take advantage of each other, try to utilize each other. We might think about this in terms of predator and prey, but my favorite examples, and we started the course with one of these, looking at the bucket orchid, Corianthes, and how it was manipulating bees, so to speak, to help it pollinate. Many orchids are manipulators in this sense. They are structured in a way that looks like a female bee and attracts bees to them, that literally are trying to mate with the orchid, make a mistake. Over time, however, if you make too many mistakes, you're not going to reproduce. So there's going to be selection against bees that make this mistake. But also, an orchid that doesn't do a good job of fooling enough bees is not going to reproduce either. So there's going to be selection for orchids that do a better job of mimicking female bees. There's going to be kind of an arms race going on between these two species that drive the orchid to be a better mimic of a female bee's body, maybe giving off a particular scent that attracts the male. And there's going to be males that are more and more discerning, and they don't get fooled by orchids that aren't quite good enough. So that, in a sense, evolution can drive up these kinds of extremes as well. So let me end by now turning to what Darwin didn't know. Darwin's theory, as I said, worked irrespective of the fact that he didn't know about how reproduction worked. He knew that we produced babies. He knew that, you know, there was fertilization in the process. That whole process was understood. But genetics was not understood. What is coincidental and ironic is that about the same time Darwin was working on his theory, another man, a man named Gregor Mendel, a monk from now what's now Czechoslovakia, was studying reproduction, was interested in how traits did get passed from one organism to another, and specifically was studying it in plants, in peas. The reason he was able to study it was that he was able to control fertilization. Remember, it takes insects to carry pollen from one flower to another. He was able to control that process. Now, you might think this is a little odd for a monk. He did it by producing what I consider to be the analog to plant condoms. He made little sock-like things that he put over the flowers, and he tied them so that bees couldn't get to the flowers. And then he and his students would periodically untie the flowers and get a little pollen from one and pollinate another. He was able to successfully breed pea plants. Now, breeding was something that, of course, was being done all the time in the 19th century. And you wanted to have specific traits, like peas with specific features to them, maybe being much more productive in terms of producing the food source. But what he found out about this process is that the reproduction of traits was not like the mixing of paints. He found out that the reproduction of traits was particulate or atomistic in a way. Not surprisingly, this was also a time when people were beginning to think about atoms of chemistry. He was thinking about atoms of inheritance. That, in effect, reproduction was the result of these particles, particulates that we today would call genes, units of generation, that's what a gene is, and their differences in combination. Because when two parents combine their atomistic reproductive elements, you have to have different combinations. And that's what I'll talk about next time, about how genetics change the story of evolution.